It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. It's coming up later, we'll hear why milk prices are down and the effect it's having on the state's dairy farmers.
First, the annual Perseid meteor shower is peaking tonight in Wisconsin, and experts expect this to be a great year to observe lots of shooting stars.
We have Bob Boniger with us now for more info about the Perseids and tips on how to best view them tonight. He's the director of the Daniel M. Sorif Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
So we get this show every year around this time. What's going on up there?
Well, the Earth in its orbit is basically plowing through a bunch of debris, dusty debris from a comet. And we do it every year around this time, August 12th, 13th.
And in general, is that what causes meteors, comet dust, so to speak?
Mostly it's comet dust. That's for the meteor showers. We can have random or sporadic meteors all the time, and that's just leftover debris from anything in the solar system.
Now, when we're talking debris, we see a pretty big light show up there. They can make a pretty big visible impact in the atmosphere. But are these big chunks we're talking about?
Oh, no. They're very, very small. Imagine going to a beach and trying to pick up one little piece of grain of sand, just one little one. That's what's making most of the meteors or shooting stars that you'll see.
Okay, so that sort of blows my mind. So I'm sitting here on planet Earth looking up what looks to be a giant fiery ball. You're telling me is a speck?
Exactly. Well, when you see a shooting star, it's not so much the little speck that's burning up, it's the heating of the air. 95% of it is the heating of the air, our atmosphere, and just 5% is the rock burning up.
Talking to Bob Boniger from the Milwaukee Public Museum about the Perseid meteor shower. Now, that's what's going on up there. Let's spend some time down here. What's the best time to check this out overnight tonight?
The best time is anywhere from midnight to dawn, which would be to about 5 a.m. It starts getting bright about then. And best thing to do is to get away from the streetlights. So a park somewhere far away, that will increase your chances of seeing about one meteor per minute, which will be great.
Now, Bob, have you done this? Do you have a favorite meteor viewing site?
Yeah, I tend to go north of the city a little bit to maybe Harrington State Park or somewhere up there. That's the best place to go. And just but anywhere from streetlights, if you can, and the further the better.
Is there any benefit to bringing, trying to do this with a telescope or binoculars?
Oh, no. The best thing to do is bring a blanket and a lawn chair and just look up. If you have a telescope and want to look at other things in between, that's great. But you really just want to relax and just look up. They happen all over the sky. They're called the Perseids because if you trace them back, they seem to come from the constellation of Perseus.
Now, you said about one a minute is the average tonight. Have there ever been meteor showers where it was more frequent than that, and might we see anything special tonight like that?
Oh, sure. No, we won't see that tonight, but there have been spectacular, what they call meteor storms, where one described it, I think, back in 1833 as raindrops almost coming down from heaven. It was so intense, but that's very rare. Tonight we're going to get a good meteor shower, one of the best of the year, but nothing to that effect.
Yeah, viewing conditions. If you're in a city, of course, it makes it hard to see. And as you mentioned, get away from the city. Where are we on the moon now? Because that has spoiled my meteor viewing in the past, and probably not just mine.
Right. The moon is near the new moon where we can't see it. There's a sliver of a moon coming up just before sunrise. So the moon will not be in the way at all. It'll be a great night. And the weather forecast looks great. So thumbs are up for all of it.
And Bob, where should we look in the night sky? Or will it be patently obvious, look at the fiery balls? Or are we going to miss them if we're looking in the wrong direction?
Well, just look all over. That's why the blanket, lawn chair, just look up. They'll seem to come from the northeast, but they'll happen all over the sky. So that's the best thing to do.
Bob, that's our big show for tonight. What other astronomical events are we looking forward to in the next couple of months?
Well, next month, on September 27th, we're going to have a total lunar eclipse, and it's the harvest moon, too, and it's also going to be the super moon of the year, so we got a super harvest eclipse moon coming up in September.
Wait, what is a super moon again?
Well, the super moon, the orbit of the moon is not perfectly circular. It's elliptical, so sometimes it brings it a little closer, and if that happens during the full moon, it appears a little bigger in the sky. It's nothing that obvious, but lately, the news has kind of picked up on it, and we can have a super moon once a year.
And the harvest moon means it's what, a little yellower?
No, it's simply the it's an effect more. It's the full moon nearest the first day of fall or the autumnal equinox, and due to the angles of the Earth and the moonrise, the moon comes up only about a half hour later each night, and that extra moonlight is what helped the farmers bring in their harvest. So that's how it got its name. But any moonrise can appear that beautiful yellowish-orangish color.
And part three of that trifecta was the a lunar eclipse. So that means the Earth blocks off the sunlight from hitting the moon. Do I have that right?
It's the moon passing through the Earth's shadow.
Okay.
As simple as that. And it will appear red, very red, sometimes orangish color. And that is due to the sunlight being bent or refracted by our atmosphere, but only the red part of the sun spectrum reaches all the way out to the moon and makes it appear red.
And there's been a lot of news lately about Pluto with the New Horizons pictures. What is the latest there?
Well, we've only got a tip of the iceberg in terms of the pictures from Pluto. We're going to get more, a lot more, and they're going to be spectacular. The ones that have come back are amazing. I mean, 2 mile ice mountains, who would have figured that? It's some canyons on its moon, Charon. I mean, the pictures are stunning already. We're going to get a lot more, but it's still kind of in taking picture mode, and it can't take pictures and send them back at the same time. So in another month or so, we're going to get a lot more pictures from Pluto.
And disappointed that Pluto's planet status hasn't been returned yet?
Personally, I just see it as a great educational opportunity to teach about planets, dwarf planets, former planets. I don't know. It's fun while it lasted. We learned, most of us out there learned Pluto as a planet. It's tough to take away a member of the family, but it's all okay. Pluto's still there out there in the sky.
Planet or not, the pictures are really cool.
Yep, exactly.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem.
That was Bob Bonager, director of the Daniel M. Soroff Planetarium at the Milwaukee Public Museum. He was with us to talk about the Perseid meteor shower peaks tonight from our viewpoint here in Wisconsin.
Milk prices in Wisconsin and around the nation are falling steadily. That means dairy farmers are taking a big hit, and it could mean a hit for the state's economy, too.
The current price that farmers are receiving for their milk is hovering around $17 per 100 pounds, or roughly 11.6 gallons. That's down from around $25 a year ago. So what's behind the falling prices? When might things turn around?
We've got Mark Stevenson here with us now in the studio. He's director of dairy policy analysis at UW-Madison. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
So we've got falling prices. The question on people's minds is why?
Well, we have a worldwide oversupply of milk right now going on. It's worse in other countries and regions than it is here. But because we're involved in international markets, what happens elsewhere matters to us, too.
So why the oversupply? Where did it come from?
We had a couple of things that have happened. One is that Oceania, meaning New Zealand and Australia, had really good production years last year. So they've produced a lot of milk. The other thing that's happened is that the two largest buyers of dairy products in the world, China and Russia, have had their own issues going on lately. And so they've kind of stepped back away from the purchasing quite as much as they had before.
And there was a boom year not too long ago, right? Did people maybe expand their operations when they should have stayed put?
Some, of course, do. But last year was the great year for dairy farmers. It was the best year that we've had in it probably a generation. So dairy farmers were in a good position to take a year like this. But that really high milk price and strong profits last year is a signal to farmers that the market's telling them we want more milk.
So that's interesting. So just last year, we had a boom year. This year, going into a bust year. Well, how come it changed that quickly?
Markets are pretty volatile, and they have been. It's that, you know, we have 40,000 dairy producers in this country all making independent decisions, and they aren't coordinated necessarily except by what price tells them to do. So you get a high price, and a lot of people will carry a few extra cows, and some people will expand. And, you know, before you know it, we have a little more milk than the market needs.
How are milk prices set?
Well, milk prices are generally set at minimum levels by either federal government in most places, like Wisconsin, or in some cases, like California, at the state level. So we survey dairy product prices, and we then try to impute what the value of milk was that went into those prices, and that sets the minimum price that can be paid for milk. Since product prices are falling, milk prices are falling.
So it's state by state then in this case, and country by country?
No, it's not so much state by state, but it can be. But California, I pointed out as being different. For the most part, federal milk marketing orders are covering the vast majority of milk in this country. And that milk price for milk going into cheese, for example, is the same all across the country.
So we've got this milk surplus right now. What happens when there's too much milk out there? I mean, literally, and also, you know, in general.
Well, first of all, you know, we will see inventories that usually start to build a little bit with some storable dairy products. Cheese is one of them, butter is another, and sometimes milk powders. And when those inventories begin to build, they put downward pressure on prices, and buyers even begin to hold off when they kind of sense that maybe prices will be falling and they can buy them at a better price a little bit later. So they fall even faster, and I think that's where we're at right now.
I've heard some stories about milk dumps, too.
There have been a few of those. Those are very unusual, not in this state that I know of, but certainly in the Northeast and in just across Lake Michigan. Michigan has had surplus milk at some periods of time, and that was more that a plant couldn't handle the amount of milk that was coming in. So just too much milk being produced for the plant, not necessarily that you couldn't find a market for it.
Does dumping it do anything to fix the supply and demand equation?
No, that's just lost in the decimal points. It's a tiny amount of milk, but it gets big headlines.
So do we see any kind of trickle-down economic effect when farmers are hit with low milk prices? When they struggle, they're part of economies, local economy and state economy. So what happens?
Sure. You know, the in a state like Wisconsin, of course, dairy is a big part of the state's economy. And when farmers aren't receiving as much income, they don't spend as much, and those dollars don't roll around in local communities as much as they otherwise would. So it does trickle down to economies all over.
We're talking to Mark Stevenson right now. He's Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. We're talking about how farmers and communities are being affected by falling milk prices. This is not just a Wisconsin problem, nationwide, even a global problem. And Mark, how important is milk and dairy to the Wisconsin economy?
It is important. It depends a little bit on the year. We have most recently had estimates that in a year like 2014 that it could contribute as much as $40 billion to the state's economy. The previous study before that was indicating about $26 billion. Big difference in milk price, so a big difference in the impact.
Now, you said we're in a decline. Have we hit the bottom yet?
I think we're pretty close to it. We may see some additional erosion. Our good fortune is that we've had a very strong domestic economy in comparison to most of the rest of the world, and demand for cheese has been strong. So that's kept prices up actually higher than they've been by quite a bit in some of the other countries I talked about, both in the European Union and in Oceania.
Now, you're in touch with the farming community here in Wisconsin. Is this enough of a downturn lasting long enough that we're seeing actual impacts, farms closing, herd sell-off, that kind of thing? Or is this the kind of thing that most farmers can weather, at least for a year or so?
Most farmers should be able to weather this. Last year was, as I mentioned, a really great year for dairy farmers, and many of them paid down debt. Many of them pre-bought more inputs like feed and fertilizer for cows than they normally would. So they're in a really good financial circumstance to go into a downturn year like this. So I don't think that most farms are going to be threatened, but it does mean that it's an uncomfortable kind of year. It's a year when you can't just buy maybe some of the things you'd like to be purchasing. You have to tighten the belt a little bit.
So you've got these falling costs for milk. What about the other costs that go into maintaining a dairy herd? Are those keeping steady or maybe going down to help out?
Well, the biggest costs for dairy farms are purchased feeds. And purchase feeds have actually been falling as well. So corn prices are much lower this year than they were last year and the year before that. Soybean prices as well, and hay prices. So to some extent, farms have been helped out with that. Other input costs have been rising modestly, but feed prices are the big one.
So is there a sense at all that this could be happening in part because people are drinking less milk?
Well, that's certainly the case. Beverage milk has been in a tailspin for a lot of years, and it doesn't seem to show any signs of stopping anytime soon. But, you know, to some extent, we find customers' category shifting. So, in other words, it used to be the case that almost everybody woke up in the morning, you had cold cereal with milk on it, and people aren't doing that as much. But maybe you're grabbing a cup of yogurt out of the refrigerator and that's your breakfast. So you're still having dairy products, but you aren't consuming beverage milk.
So here in Wisconsin, could we help out by drinking more milk or would we not have an impact?
You can always help out by drinking more milk. And of course, we encourage people to do that. It's a great, nutritious, healthful product.
Now, I read that the number of dairy farms in Wisconsin right now is down below 10,000. This for the first time in over a century. What is your take on that?
We've been consolidating dairy farms for a long period of time. Many fewer farms, and the farms that remain get larger and larger. So we're producing more milk than ever before. So you can't look at that and say our dairy industry is going away. It's changing. It's morphing over time. 10,000 is a nice round number, and it's one that people get excited about. But the trend hasn't really changed very much at all in the past many years.
And looking again at these milk prices that are falling, any idea about when we could expect to see a turnaround?
I think that by the time we get into the first quarter of 2016, we could begin to see prices turn around. I think it'll take that long before we work off some inventories of products and maybe other countries are ready to step in and purchase dairy products again.
Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're very welcome.
That was Mark Stevenson, Director of Dairy Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about how farmers and communities are being affected by falling milk prices.
A judge ruled on Monday that the 13-year-old suspect in the so-called Slenderman case will be tried in an adult court. The two girls are accused of stabbing a classmate last year to impress a fictional character called Slenderman.
According to Wisconsin law, the charge of attempted murder required the two to be tried in the adult system. Juvenile defendants are allowed to ask for a transfer to the juvenile system, but the ruling on Monday denied that request from defense attorneys.
Monday's ruling raises the wider question, when is it appropriate to try juvenile offenders in the adult legal system? Two guests join us now. Tina Freiberger is chair and associate professor in the Department of Criminal Justice at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. Tina, thanks for joining us today.
Hello, hi.
And also with us is Kim Dvorak. She's executive director of the National Juvenile Defender Center. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Tina, we'll start with you. When a judge in Wisconsin is weighing a case like this, whether to move juveniles from the adult courts into the juvenile system, what kind of factors are they weighing in that decision?
Well, usually judges will consider factors that were related to the offense. Those lots of times have, you know, the most profound impact, such as the severity of the offense, obviously, what kind of prior records that the juvenile has. They also may consider the age of the juvenile and the needs of the juvenile, and that would include their treatment needs, and also, too, their mental health needs as well.
And, Tina, how do Wisconsin's laws for juveniles in adult courts compare with other states?
Well, Wisconsin is actually pretty strict. They're stricter than most states with juveniles. One is the statutory exclusionary rule that puts 10-year-olds convicted of murder or attempted murder into the adult system automatically. And also, too, the other thing that really sets us apart is this idea that a 17-year-old is actually considered to be an adult immediately.
Let's turn to Kim Dvorak now. Kim, your organization has made the case that we should be reluctant at most to try minors as adults. Why is that?
Because all of the developmental research confirms that children are different from adults, that their brains are still developing, that their sense of identity is still developing, and that they're still capable of change and rehabilitation. And this research has been relied upon by the United States Supreme Court in now four major decisions regarding juveniles. The children are simply different from adults, and we fail when we treat them as if they are adults.
So they might be capable of change and rehabilitation more so than an adult suspect?
Correct. That is correct.
Now, in the ruling on Monday, Kim, the judge said, quote, there has to be assurance to the public and to these defendants as well that a serious offense has to be dealt with on a serious basis that offers protection to everyone. So is there a case to be made here for public safety being a factor in this decision, regardless of the age of the accused?
Not regardless with respect to the age of the accused. When it comes to children, the seriousness of the offense really should not be the governing factor, that we really need to look at their individual characteristics because they really are developing year by year, even throughout the course of one of these cases. And so without any strong evidence that these children are incapable of rehabilitation or incapable of being treated, it really serves all of our interests that they get the treatment they need in a juvenile justice system, and not in an adult system.
We are talking about juvenile suspects in the adult criminal justice system, asking when should minors be tried as adults, if ever. Tina Freiberger from UW-Milwaukee is with us. Kim Dvorak from the National Juvenile Defender Center. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Let's turn to outcomes for minors in the adult system. Tina, what do we know about recidivism rates for minors who go through the juvenile system versus the adult court system?
A pretty good handful of studies that have been done on this, and what they find is that juveniles who go through the adult system are actually more likely to recidivate than juveniles who go through the juvenile system. And when they look at juveniles who recidivate in both systems, they find that those who go through the adult system actually tend to commit more serious crimes once out of the system than those who went through the juvenile system.
So, Kim, that makes me wonder what kind of programs young offenders need that they might get in the juvenile system that they won't get in the adult system.
Well, certainly therapy, number one. My understanding is that there are some mental health implications for both of these young girls, and they need considerable mental health care. To my knowledge, that simply is not available in the adult system unless you have a very serious psychiatric disorder. You might end up in a psychiatric prison. But the juvenile system was designed for developing children. So hopefully, we hope that the people who work in the juvenile system are trained in providing cognitive behavioral therapy, are trained in providing whatever mental health resources these young girls might need, and they're also trained in understanding just what a normal adolescent would be going through during this period. They're simply prone to more risk-taking behavior. They can make bad decisions, particularly when they're under stress or when they're with a peer. Even the Supreme Court has recognized that peer influence and negative peer influences have a substantial effect on the behavior that children engage in. And with girls this young, it's unfathomable to me that the adult system could provide any of their needs.
We'll go to a caller now. We've got Bruce on the line in Partyville. Bruce, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I think so far the discussion has focused on the aspects of rehabilitation theories of punishment, but there is another part of the punishment theory, and that is retribution or the societal need for punishment itself. And those two things do need to be balanced. You can't focus exclusively on the aspect of rehabilitation, or ultimately society becomes dissatisfied with the system itself.
Bruce, thanks a lot. A sense, Kim, that justice isn't done if we only focus on rehabilitation for what might be a heinous crime at the outset.
And certainly retribution has been a traditional justification for punishment. You know, what the Supreme Court has found is that the case for retribution is simply not as strong with children, that because their culpability is diminished not only by their age but also by potential individual characteristics or mental health needs, that justification simply isn't as strong when we're talking about children.
And staying with punishment for a moment, Tina, as I understand Wisconsin law, under 17, until you're 17, you can't be put in an adult prison facility. So what, assuming a minor is found guilty, what options are there? Where do they go if they're convicted?
Well, the lots of times they will start off in the juvenile system, but then at some point they are transferred into the adult system. And the whole idea is that they won't be transferred until they reach 18, but that's not really, that doesn't really always happen. I mean, there's not a lot of good estimates, good statistics that are put out recently on this, but like in 2009, the U.S. Bureau of Prisons reported that there was actually 37 kids in the state of Wisconsin that were 16 or under who were in adult state prison.
As I understand it, again, that's not supposed to happen. How does that happen then?
Right. Well, it does happen, and it can happen sometimes with transferred youth, because the federal regulation for it is the out of sight, out of sound is the requirement, so that juveniles are kept out of sight and out of sound of adult offenders. So that can actually mean solitary confinement for juveniles, which can also lead to a whole host of additional mental health problems.
We're talking about juvenile justice and adult courts with Tina Freiberger from UW-Milwaukee and Kim Dvorak from the National Juvenile Defender Center. After a judge's ruling this week that the now 13-year-old suspects in the Slender Man attempted murder case will stay in adult court.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. When should minors be tried in adult court? Have you ever been involved in a court case where this decision had to be made? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our discussion about juvenile suspects being tried in the adult court system. Tina Freiberger from UW-Milwaukee is with us, and Kim Dvorak with the National Juvenile Defender Center.
And you can join the discussion at 800-642-1234. When, if ever, do you think younger offenders should be tried in adult courts? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go back to our callers with Liz in Silver Lake. Liz, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. So I wanted to address the point where I am in Wisconsin, that juvenile offenders are not serving time in adult facilities. And my son, when he was 16, he's now 21, but when he was 16, he was remanded to adult court and served time for I think it was considered a burglary. I mean, attempted burglary. And while there, he was attacked and by two men in the bathroom. And so it was, it's not true. They do serve time in adult court. I mean, in adult facilities.
Liz.
Yeah, juveniles in the adult system are actually, when they are in adult facilities, they're a lot more likely to be victimized. When a national survey done by the U.S. Bureau of Prisons found that 13% of inmates that were sexually victimized were kids, were under 18, and that doesn't sound like a large number, but it really is when we look at the fact that there's less than 1% of the jail population is actually minors.
And Kim, what does this look like nationally? Is this common that we end up with minors in prison and facing these situations as Liz's son did?
Well, unfortunately, it has been fairly common. There has been over 200,000, 250,000 children in adult courts across the country, and I can't tell you exactly what percentage of those end up in an adult prison facility. We are working across the country with multiple advocacy organizations to reduce the prosecution of children and to reduce the incarceration of children in the adult criminal justice system. I think particularly when it comes to persons who were 12 years of age at the time of the offense, it would be very rare that we would find those cases. And that is a law change that really should be considered to raise the age that we would allow to 12-year-olds to be prosecuted as adults really is just very much inconsistent with the national landscape.
Liz, thanks for the call. Good luck to you and your family. Ryan is with us next in Milwaukee. Ryan, hi.
Hey, what's happening?
What did you want to bring up, Ryan?
Hey, I've worked in a lot of other states dealing with youth, especially youth offenders, and out east, Ohio, Maryland, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin locks up youth for a lot of minor drug offenses. I work a lot in Racine County, Milwaukee County, and for small amounts of marijuana, kids are being sentenced to prison time, and it just blows my mind. And while I go and visit them in juvenile detention facilities, they sit a very long time, even before they get to even go to court. Which boggles me, blows my mind that it's not even brought up anywhere, that kids sit 3, 4, 5, 6 months before they even see a judge to be sentenced, you know, and then when they get sentenced, they're charged as an adult, and these kids take these charges so often because these lawyers are like, you might as well just get charged as an adult, because sometimes they're able to get out even earlier, you know, as being charged as an adult, but, you know, little do they know that that record's going to be with them for the rest of their life, you know, it's just a lot of foolishness being in this state, and that compared to a lot of other states, and it's just not brought to the table. I don't think a lot of people know what's really going on.
And Ryan, you're working as a social worker, as I understand it. You
yes.
what effect do you think this has on the people you're working with then?
Oh, it's horrible. I mean, for the families, for the youth, you know, just long-term effect. And kids, like you were saying, the statistics, when kids get locked up, and I say kids, they're not adults, you know, especially for minor drug offenses or very, just some of these lesser charges, they're going to get locked back up. Like they said, they're going to prison, so they have to act like adults. They have to act like a grown man in prison. Prison is so different than a juvenile detention facility. They deal with so many other different issues and just having to grow up way too quick and being around that whole element of hardcore criminals, you know, and more gangs and gangs from other parts of the state or other states, you know, and just growing up way too quick.
Ryan, thanks a lot for the call. Tina, you mentioned recidivism rates earlier. Is that part of the story here, that a kid, a youth in adult prison is meeting and having to live with all of these more hardened criminals and learning from them?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, there's a really popular, well-supported theory in criminology, the social learning theory, that finds that, you know, kids as well as adults learn crime and criminal behaviors and different criminal behaviors from their peers, from other individuals. So, yes, when they're surrounded by other more advanced adult criminals, of course, they're going to learn additional criminal behaviors. Plus, you know, the caller also brought up a really good point about the fact that once a kid is in the adult system, that's on their record, and then that follows them, which makes it more difficult once they're out, you know, to gain employment, find a place to live in some cases, and all of those things relate to recidivism.
Kim, are there states you would point to as examples for dealing with juvenile crime issues?
You know, there are lots of states that are reforming their laws around the prosecution of children as adults. If you look at the Campaign for Youth Justice website, they are a national advocacy organization, and they point to 4 trends around the reduction in prosecuting kids as adults. And one of them is to really change the age range in which these children can be prosecuted as adults. I'm from the state of Colorado, and we recently raised the age for prosecutorial charging in adult court to 16 years of age, requiring that children begin in the juvenile justice system. We've also implemented more procedural protections around prosecuting children as adults. You know, in the 90s, there was a very significant movement to get tough on crime, and that included getting tough on kids. And we really adultified our juvenile justice systems. And what we're seeing now is that we are informed by adolescent development research. We are informed by the research that shows locking kids up leads to worse outcomes. And so states are taking a second look and rolling back laws to make their systems more developmentally appropriate that ultimately make our communities more safe.
Thanks to both our guests in this conversation, Tina Freiberger from UW-Milwaukee, Kim Dvorak from the National Juvenile Defender Center, talking about juvenile justice in adult courts.